Hello everyone, Dave here. I just wanted to note up front that this bonus episode of Film Strips was actually recorded back at the start of the COVID shutdown, and was planned to have been released shortly thereafter, after we recorded it, but unfortunately, due to a combination of work and, you know, everybody dealing with the fact that there was this mass pandemic going on, this sort of fell through the cracks. So, if you're wondering why a few of the references don't refer back to our GoldenEye episode, or why something seems like this is referencing something a little bit out of date, that's the reason here. Stay tuned for our regular schedule to resume following this episode next week. And welcome to a very special bonus episode of Film Strips, which may possibly become a recurring bonus segment when we need to buy some time. I don't know. I'm Dave Babbitt, however, and who is with me today? Because it's not Andrew Kanegeiser, as usual. Would you care to introduce yourself, sir?
Hello, everyone. It's me, James Ripnack.
Thank you for joining us, James. You might remember him from previous appearances on the show, such as our Lost Highlander one, which I guess you wouldn't remember, hence the being lost part of that. And I'm trying to remember, the last time you joined us was for which film?
It was Dominion.
Oh, right. Yes, it was Dominion. Oh, how could I possibly forget that episode where
Beautiful
Andrew raged...
Christmas Eve.
Yeah, before all the world went to hell.
Oh, yeah. It seems like a lifetime ago.
But yes, we're doing something a little different on the show compared to what we normally do, because as I think as I've stated before on the show, and maybe you have as well, James, you and I think both share a general interest in a certain subsect of film fandom, or a certain component of film fandom that maybe isn't necessarily as well-known these days, or at least not as talked about as it may have been when you and I were growing up.
That's
and
true.
What would that be?
I would say this is, before I reveal it to everyone, I would also like to say that this, Dave, quite possibly is the nerdiest endeavor we have both ever undertaken. Right?
I honestly can't debate that, because you're right. That this really is.
Today, we're talking about novelizations.
Yes. The highly acclaimed literary form that's, you know, clearly discussed at length in academia. The novelization, which I guess is one of those things that it might be a little bit harder for younger generations to sort of wrap their mind around. But once upon a time, it was not easy to access movies on a regular basis. And also, you know, you had to promote your film in a variety of different ways. And
ancillary marketing.
Yeah. So in order to basically kill two birds with one stone, what ended up happening was this form known as the novelization came into existence. So the idea of, instead of adapting a novel and to the big screen, we would have the exact reverse. Now, basically, feature films being adapted into novels to be released on the market, so that, yes, you could see the poster for these things on any bookstore you would go into, and hey, if the film went out of print or disappeared quickly, at least you could somehow revisit it in some form afterwards. Or if you were like me, you would read the novelization before you saw the film, because these things would come out like 2 to 3 months beforehand, because spoiler culture wasn't a thing once upon a time.
That's true. But also, if... maybe you weren't allowed to see the movie. Like, let's say Aliens, I wouldn't be able to rent that. But you know what? Yeah. No one at the laundromat that sold books is going to blink an eye if I purchased that book for 75 cents.
Absolutely. Or would anybody blink an eye when I was in Zeller's and buying the novelization of The Cable Guy, which I did read several times over the years. I wish I could find my copy of that now. I guess to sort of open up here, James, I mean, obviously we're both film nerds, so I guess there is that immediate appeal, but what was it about the novelization that really appealed to you, I guess, growing up, and maybe still does, as it were?
Well, why it still appeals to me is just, I just find it, like, absolutely fascinating, just, like, the convergence of, like, I don't even know if art is the right word, But, like, yeah. Art and marketing, and just the way those two things intertwine, right?
Yeah.
Like, I find that incredibly interesting. And what I've, like, as a kid, like, growing up in, like, the late 80s, early 90s, how I just liked it because, like, again, like, the theater to home video window was, could be huge,
yeah.
Right? So, like, I saw Batman Summer 89, and then who knows, like, it was constantly in theaters, and I wasn't going to go, like, I couldn't go see it again, obviously, yeah. Right? Like, so I bought the novel because I wanted to relive that experience, and I don't know, like that kind of stuff.
No, absolutely. I'm in complete agreement with you there. I mean, that was sort of my initial gateway into it as well, and was buying these novels and reading them and going through them as a way to, again, sort of experience the film, even for just from, I wouldn't have been able to articulate it at the time, but from a different vantage point, mm-hmm. seeing how it comes when you shift its gear into another form. And I was not necessarily picky with the ones I picked up, as the cable guy anecdote there probably yeah. made note. But I mean, it, part of the other thing that sort of, I guess, the more I would learn about film that really appealed to me was realizing that, and oftentimes these books were being cranked out relatively fast.
Yeah.
And while the film was still in production, which led to usually some weird instances where novelizations could be insight into where the film was in development at a certain point in time, and realizing there are certain ideas or scenes or sequences that maybe we never saw or weren't even necessarily filmed
yeah.
that did exist at one point in time. And my God, here's the evidence that yes, maybe some of it did exist at one point in time. Certainly.
Yeah. A lot of the times, like, they're based off of, like, early drafts or shooting scripts sort of thing. And I think one of the interesting things that I had heard about was whoever ended up writing the novelization of Star Wars, which was actually credited to George Lucas. Like, they were writing it before any of, like, creature designs were fully realized or, like that kind of, like, the otherworldly stuff. Right.
Yeah.
And so some of the descriptions of those don't quite mesh with what, you know, we finally get on screen. And I find that stuff really interesting.
Oh yeah, no, absolutely, I'm in the same boat. But funny, if they had the same issue with the Star Wars comic adaptation that Marvel originally published mm-hmm. in 77 as well, where, you know, the Jabba the Hutt, that scene does appear in the comic, and Jabba notably does not look like you would expect him to, if you're familiar with his later design that was created for Return of the Jedi. But on top of that, I mean, the other, I guess, benefit, in addition to getting sort of a sense of missing material or the could have beens in terms of a feature film, there's also the case where sometimes you had novelists who, they would be given the screenplays for these films, and their immediate reaction was, this makes no sense, or this is crap, and I need to improve this, if only for my own sanity. And certainly a number of writers have taken that approach over the years. Probably, I think the most notorious was Dean Koontz and Tobe Hooper's film Funhouse.
Oh.
Where, yeah, he basically invents entire sections, whole cloth of whole new material.
Really?
It's unbelievable. Like, it's basically a completely different work with very little overlap with the Tobe Hooper film. Now, having said that, I actually like the movie version of Funhouse, and I find
as
Dean Koontz utterly insufferable as a person, particularly as you read his introduction to the novelization, to the reprints of the Funhouse novelization, where he basically lambasts Tobe Hooper as, well, he screwed it up and didn't know what he was doing, even though, again, Koontz, you were hired to write a novelization. I mean,
yeah.
Really, what are you defending in terms of the Funhouse script? I can't imagine it was much, but
that's really interesting. I didn't know Koontz did that. Like, usually, like, novelizations aren't really given to name, quote unquote, name authors, right? I mean, like, unless you consider Max Allen Collins, like, a big name who seemingly wrote, like, a ton of novelizations.
Well, yeah, I think in the case of Koontz, it was because he wasn't originally published under his name. He was very early in his career getting started, but eventually his pseudonym was revealed, and a lot of people have checked out that novel, so much so that it's been republished under his name in the year since, which not most novelizations don't have that happen. Reprints are rare, to say the least, unless your name, your film or your book was titled Star Wars or Star Trek.
Yeah.
Necessarily.
Oh, yeah, I forgot. Man, I read all those novelizations, too.
Oh, God, yeah, no. But, and
bringing back, like, a lot of memories in this episode, Dave.
And I think that's kind of the thing. I mean, part of my appeal is, yeah, it's still, there is that sort of nostalgia factor that goes with it, but there is something... As I look over at my shelf and I see the novelization of film of films such as The Dark Knight Rises or the Omen sequels, which is hilarious given that I hate the Omen movies so much. But that's the thing. Like, I mean, there really is that appeal to going back and checking out. And I do regret selling some of the ones I had as a kid.
Yeah, me too, right? But, like, you know, when you're... Sometimes you can't hold on to everything. You think, like, maybe I won't ever read this novelization of Superman 3 again. So, you know, pawn it off.
Well, absolutely. Although now that you see me just scrolling through, it's like, let's take a look at the Amazon secondary sellers lists and see if I can find Batman and Robin.
Oh, boy. All
these years later. It, funny enough, it does improve on the film. It barely, but it does. At least my childhood memories say that.
Yeah.
But let's just maybe turn our attention then to what exactly we're doing here, which is, I thought it would be fun, and maybe it is, maybe I'm horribly wrong in this, folks, to take a look at, you know, particular novelizations in relationship to the films they are novelizing. And I don't want to say deep dive, because that would imply a far more work than I think either me or anybody who would want to be involved in this endeavor would want to put in. But at least, you know, do the research and read the books in question and see... Well, what do we make of this? What would we maybe have wanted out of them at the time these were published? What do we find interesting about them now? And James, if there's one thing that anybody who's listened to film strips or the show you and I used to do prior to this, Cinema Chase, yes, thank you. It's been so long.
Again, a lifetime ago.
Yeah. This way, in this instance, I mean, we are both huge Bond fans, I think it's safe to say. Yeah. So, I mean, the funny thing is that I figured, well, let's turn our attention to some of the Bond novelizations, which is interesting because, A, Bond begins as a literary creation to start with, which makes this a little bit more of a unique situation. But more to the point, I figure, well, what novelizations do we easily have on hand that exist in the Bond films? Because there's only 6 in total. And naturally, I decided that we should basically turn to probably the foremost one and most interesting one, or at the one that was cheapest and easiest to get our hands on.
It's the only one my library had.
Yeah. Die Another Day by Raymond Benson. The 6th and thus far last novelization of a Bond film. So, I mean, I guess before we dive into this 2002 endeavor in earnest, where would you like to begin, James, I guess, with this one? What do you think?
I don't know. I mean, like... We could talk about how did we get here? I guess. I'm not sure. Like, we could talk about Raymond Benson, who was, I think, the third person after Fleming to take over writing James Bond novels, like, in earnest.
Yeah, because the quick history being that, yes, in 1953 sees the publication of Casino Royale, the very first James Bond novel ever, written by Ian Fleming. He's the creator. He goes on to write, I believe it's 14 books in total. 12 of them are novels, and I think 2 of them are short story collections. I
believe so.
Yeah, and then he passes away following the trials built around plagiarism claims for Thunderball. That's a whole nother story to get into at another point in time, and which we did on Cinema Chase.
That's true, we did.
Yeah, but what ends up happening is that following Fleming's death, the rights holder to the Bond novels don't necessarily want it to end. And I believe it's Kingsley Amis is the first one to write after Fleming, the James Bond novel,
Colonel Sun. Yeah, which I thought, on a side note, which I had assumed that Die Another Day was going to adapt in some part or another, which...
Well, it rips off some stuff, but not quite adapt, so... Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I mean, yeah, and for anybody who hasn't read that one, I highly recommend it. It might just be the best of the immediate, or of the post-Fleming novels.
Well, I'm gonna go to bat for Special Services by John Gardner, but...
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I mean, basically following that novel, Bond really, as a literary figure, kind of ends for, I think, around a solid decade until the late 70s, particularly 1977, because the Bond films, which are adaptations of Fleming's works, are still coming out at this point. And I believe it's 75, The Spy Who Loved Me is released. If I'm not mistaken, I think that's the
77. The Spy Who Loved
Me. It is 77 it comes out?
Yep.
Okay. So that one comes out, and the thing about The Spy Who Loved Me, for anybody who's read Fleming's original novel, is that basically the film adaptation has nothing in common with the novel at all. And for once, it's not because the filmmakers ignored the book so much as Fleming told them, please seriously ignore this book. It doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
Because I have you read the original Fleming novel in that instance, James?
I did, but with like 25 years ago now, Dave.
Yeah, it's like it's a really different beast where basically we see the story entirely from a woman's perspective, mm-hmm. and it's about her life that just so happens to intersect with Bond and gangsters at a motel.
Yeah.
Yeah, like it really is incredibly atypical of the Bond novels as a whole and very different from anything else Fleming ever wrote.
Yeah, not entirely successful, but interesting nonetheless.
Yeah, but effectively the film that ends up being produced with that title is so radically different that as part of the promotion for it, it's decided that by effectively the producers of the film, well, why don't we novelize this again? In which, yes, the estate of Ian Fleming and those who control the rights to the Bond novel said, okay, fine, we'll do it, but we're taking charge of it. And the individual who ends up writing it is Christopher Wood, who, yes, writes the novelization for The Spy Who Loved Me as James Bond, The Spy Who Loved Me. See, we get a slightly different title there to make the distinguish there, which is published in 77 and is apparently a big enough hit that when it comes time to do Moonraker a little later, they do the same thing. We end up with Wood novelizing Moonraker as James Bond and Moonraker because, yeah, I'm not sure referring to him as Moonraker would have made as much sense at that point as a description because I'm still not, I mean, what the hell is Moonraker really even to this point?
What isn't Moonraker? Come on, Dave.
True, true. But in 1979... yes, that film is novelized as well, before the novelizations sort of stop at this point in time, because, again, the adaptations that would, or the films that would follow, are somewhat closer to Fleming books, if you squint and look at it, for the most part.
Yeah, but like, basically, all of the films are just cut-and-paste pastiches of all the novels, right? Like, coral reef scene that's in the film For Your Eyes Only appears in the novel Live and Let Die. The scene in the novel Live and Let Die where Felix Leiter gets his half eaten by a shark appears in the film License to Kill, which is actually not based on any prior works of Fleming's. They just basically, aside from like the first few films, like Dr. No, From Russia with Love, Goldfinger, Thunderball, like they all sort of start to cherry pick, the writers and producers start to cherry pick scenes and ideas, set pieces really, mostly, for the films.
Well, absolutely. And it's really telling that when we talk about like James Bond, the literary version of Bond as created by Ian Fleming is, it's recognizably still the character that more or less appears in the film, but they are still very different in many ways, particularly in the not Sean Connery, not Daniel Craig, not Timothy Dalton versions. So basically, yes, Roger Moore and Pierce Brosnan are substantially different from what Fleming put down on the page, because his Bond is much more of a hardened killer in many ways. And the missions he goes on are more, they're still spy fantasy, but they're ostensibly more realistic compared to what we would often see in the Bond films. And you certainly don't get big, major action set pieces like in quite the same way.
They're a lot more I don't know that subdued's the right word, but like they're more down to earth, let's say. Less fantastic. Like, there's no space laser battles or, I don't know, submarines
like you're big
being eaten by bigger submarines.
Well, exactly. It's more about suspense, or, you know, when you get into sort of more elaborate things, you get things like the Shatterhand Garden in For Your Eyes Only, which is, you know, it's like, it's a garden and it's filled with all sorts of poisonous plants that can kill you and people come here to commit suicide. It's like, okay, yeah, that's about as far as Fleming would go. Or Man with the Golden Gun, where, you know, world's greatest assassin, and oh, let's go hang out at his house, basically, where Playboy-style antics are going on around this time. And yes, not just in terms of the magazine, in terms of also just the graphicness of the content, we'll say, in that book. But the big thing, yeah, I mean, so when you get to the Bond films, obviously, they tend to amp it up and make it more spectacular, and certainly as time went on, that became a major part of it. Now, come the early 1980s, based on, the success of these novelizations, the Fleming estate and the rights holders to the Bond character as a literary figure decide, well, we can bring back the Bond novels, and yes, enter John Gardner to basically become the official writer of all future canon Bond novels, at least for a time. And he starts off writing basically original adventures that, you know, update Bond for the 80s slightly, but are continuing on from Fleming's original works. Until 1989, when, yes, License to Kill, the film is released, the first Bond film that ostensibly is not based on any of Fleming's work, even if it is still cherry-picking scenes. And they decide that, yes, we want a novelization again. And Gardner ends up writing the novelization. So there ends up being this weird period where the sort of intersection of literary Bond and film Bond sort of come to a head in the form of John Gardner, and then eventually in the form of Gardner's successor, Raymond Benson, who would take over and write 6 original Bond novels as well, and novelize the final 3 Pierce Brosnan films as well, starting with Tomorrow Never Dies, and then ending up with Die Another Day in 2002. Now, I guess this basically brings us to the film in question and the novel in question.
Which we have successfully put off for 20 minutes.
Yeah, I guess we can't avoid this forever. So let's cut back to 2002 here for a minute, folks, because Die Another Day is kind of a...
special?
Like it or not. Yeah.
Notable?
It's a significant... Yeah. Yeah, there are several reasons why this film is notable, both in hindsight and for what it was going on at the time, because this was released in 2002, which was at that time the 40th anniversary of the film version of James Bond from the release of Dr. No back in 1962.
And also the 20th film in the franchise.
Exactly. It would also, in hindsight being 2020, the final film for Pierce Brosnan, and also the end of the original Bond continuity, which... yes, was a thing that actually technically existed, even if it was one of those squint and while you look at it forms of continuity.
Yeah.
But yeah, so Die Another Day was supposed to be a big celebration movie, you know, because 20th film, 40th anniversary, you know, we got Pierce Brosnan, who, again, it's harder to remember, maybe in light of the success of the Daniel Craig series, and also the fact that Daniel Craig's now technically been playing Bond for 3 decades at this point, as I finally occurred to me. First actor to have done that through the official canon. I mean, Connery, technically, if you count Never Say Never Again.
True.
But yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where, yeah, Pierce Brosnan's Bond, I mean, comes at an interesting point where, number one, this, with the end of the Cold War, the franchise has to reinvent itself and prove that this character still has a place on the big screen. And again, Pierce Brosnan, you know, sort of ushering in and reintroducing Bond, I think, for many people through that film with GoldenEye. And he cemented his place, certainly, I think, with the 4 films he did.
Mm-hmm.
However, I think it's also willing to note that he did not go out on a high note when it comes to this film. So I guess, James, I mean, I'll leave it open to you first about your reactions and opinions on Die Another Day and what it is.
So, I mean, like, oh, I don't even know where to begin. like, when I first saw it in, again, because 2002, in my early 20s, I'm still, like, head over heels for James Bond, right? Like, I got excited every time there was a new one. I would always go see him opening night. And I will say this. So, I love GoldenEye. I think it's one of the best of the series. Tomorrow Never Dies is pretty forgettable, but whatever. But I am actually a strong, staunch supporter of The World Is Not Enough. I think I think that movie is half of the best Bond movie ever made.
That's a bold statement.
It is a bold statement. It's also the quarantine talking, probably. But like, a lot of that movie is pretty spectacular and pretty great. And then it, like, some of it's campy as all get out and doesn't work. But I was looking forward to Die Another Day. And on first blush, I thought, yeah, you know what? It's fine. It's not my favorite Pierce Brosnan. It's possibly the worst, but I still thought it was fine. But as time has gone on, I have slowly come to hate this movie.
Okay. And yeah, definitely.
Like, it is, say what you will about the campiness and the quote-unquote datedness of the Moore era, or even, like, the Connery era, of, like, how, like, you know, like, the swinging 60s, or, like, whatever the hell was going on in the 70s with Moore.
Yeah.
Right? Like, no movie, no Bond movie has firmly planted its feet in its time than Die Another Day. Like, none of this movie has aged well.
I will agree definitely that this film hasn't aged well. I might not still say it's the worst. I mean, it's up there. It's definitely one of the worst. I think Octopussy still probably, if only because that one is so, so dull.
It's pretty boring.
Yeah. By comparison, that Die Another Day at least occasionally seems to have something resembling a pulse.
I don't know. I was going to say, it has the unfortunate distinction of being made in 2002, which is also one of the worst times for action movies in terms of, you know, aesthetics and style, and, like, as a genre, unbeknownst to all the people making action movies, what to do with the turn of the millennium. Similar to how, like, when the Cold War ended, we're like, well, who should the bad guys be if they're not the Russians anymore, right? So,
yeah.
So movies are just throwing anything at the wall and seeing what sticks. And around this time, like your post, Ronin, let's say, which I consider, like, the last great analog action movie, and, like, into this era from, like, 98 to 2002, just, like, figuring out on a technical level, like, how do we make an action movie with practical stunts, practical effects, but also how do we make things look awesome and better with, you know, CGI? And so that's unfortunately where Die Another Day lands. It's, like, the most glaringly obvious bad special effects.
You're not wrong. And I think it's unfortunate because, again, when you look at this on paper in terms of who's involved in this film, you would probably at least have some modest expectations for it. Because sure, the director on the movie is Lee Tomahari. Now, he is I believe a Maori filmmaker from New Zealand. Yeah. And he had directed a phenomenal film.
Once We're Warriors.
Yeah, Once We're
Warriors. Just an incredible film.
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, that thing will emotionally devastate you and ruin you.
Yes.
And, I mean, it was keeping with a trend of interesting directing choices that had sort of started with the Brosnan era, because at this point in time, the series had moved away from sort of the long standing hands that had worked on the series repeatedly over the years, mm-hmm, and was actively injecting some form of new fresh blood while at the same time keeping the general crew on these movies
more or less the same. All the second unit people are pretty much the same.
Yes, but instead, you know, we would have, in the case of the GoldenEye, we would have Martin Campbell making his debut for the first of two Bond films, mm-hmm, and maybe one day he'll do another one.
We can only hope. Yeah. When people hear Campbell's name now, right, like, they think of his two Bond movies primarily, but also, like, the Zorro film, which he made after GoldenEye, just, like, it's a straight-up adventure movie, and, like, his bomb of Green Lantern. But, like, prior to being chosen for GoldenEye, he had mostly done, like, a lot of, like, really high-classy British TV kind of movies, right? Like, so, and, like, a couple of, like, lawyery movies from the early 90s, which aren't super great.
Yeah, but no, you're absolutely right. Yeah, he comes out of that school, and then Michael Apted, who did The World Is Not Enough, certainly isn't that,
who has, like, one of the most interesting and varied careers of any director.
Absolutely. And Roger Spottiswood, which, okay, maybe that one's the odd one out in this instance. That's stop or my mom will shoot. Yeah, that's what we did.
He worked, but Spottiswood worked with what's his name, who did, like, Wild Bunch, Sam Peckinpah.
Yeah, he has
a lot.
Yeah,
he also directed Terror Train with Jamie Lee Curtis.
He does. I mean, he is a more interesting filmmaker than at first glance, but he's also the one where you just look at it and it's like, I'm not sure how the dots led up to this being the choice to direct a Bond movie.
Oh, like, he's doing a job.
Well, fair, yeah.
They needed someone who they wanted someone who who would listen to them.
Well, effectively, yeah. And that's certainly the case. But yeah, I mean, to come to this, I mean, you have Lee Tomahari as at least an interesting choice to direct this film. Yeah. But he's also working with some people who had been around for the series for quite a while at this point. Based on, I mean, let's start with our screenwriters, Neil Purvis and Robert Wade, who either are beloved or loathed, depending upon who you talk to, and usually both by the same audience, as it were, when it comes to the Bond series. Because, yeah, I'm trying to remember, I think it's Tomorrow Never Dies is where they begin, if I'm not mistaken. In terms of their...
I believe that is correct. Yeah. I am stalling for time while I'm looking that up.
Yeah, but the big thing is that they had been around for at least one or two films by the time they had gotten around to writing Die Another Day. And they were typically, basically, sort of, they're sure reliable hands who knew how to turn in what presumably the Bond producers wanted on these films.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they know the template inside and out. And it was World's Not Enough was their first one.
Okay.
Which has another writing credit of Bruce Feirstein. So this was the first one that they had done on their own.
Yeah. And that's definitely worth noting, seeing as how basically every film they've worked on since has been either rewritten on them, or they did rewrites for them since.
Yeah, they bonded it up.
Yeah, exactly. But they write the screenplay for this film, but part of the marching order seems to be that, yes, because this is going to be the big anniversary film, this is the 20th Bond film, is to make it seemingly sort of a celebratory film in that way. And when you watch this movie, the version of celebratory they go with is that basically we are going to steal a little bit from each of the preceding 19 Bond films, bit by bit, and stitch it together in a way that sort of makes sense. And yeah, you take that very fractured framework, which I will say this, I think the film, you can easily, when you look at the film version, divide it into sort of three sections, which I think progressive work to certain degrees. The opening section of the film, I think, is easily the best, where basically it is Bond in, for those who haven't seen the film, I guess we'll just give the quick rundown of the plot of this thing, which is effectively on a mission in North Korea to assassinate an up-and-coming colonel in the North Korean army. Bond ends up killing his target, but is captured by General Moon. Yes, the slight ripoff of Colonel Sun that we were referring to earlier, which leads to Bond basically spending 18 months in a North Korean prisoner of war prison where he is tortured nonstop. He is eventually released when it's as part of a prisoner exchange, when it becomes seemingly becomes the case that Bond is giving away secrets while under the influence of the drugs and beatings he's been given.
Yeah.
And of course, because it's James Bond, he knows he's not really responsible, and he's hell-bent on finding out who actually betrayed him and what's really going on. Somehow this inevitably involves, okay,
Diamond Magnet Gustav Graves and his Icarus satellite that will create ostensibly a second sun?
Yes, and we should also note this involves basically people having genetic modification to their bodies to turn them wholesale into whole different ethnicities.
Yes.
Which, we'll get there. And
yep.
Yeah, eventually James Bond teaming up slash getting coming into contact with a new secret agent, one who theoretically was maybe going to get her own spin-off franchise, Jinx, played by Halle Berry. And okay, yeah, so when you look at this film, you've got the early section of the movie, which is basically closer to maybe, if you squint at it, an Ian Fleming novel, where it's like, okay, Bond is on a mission, Bond gets captured, Bond, you know, goes rogue and has to piece things together. It is a very small, and again, for the, I mean, there's still obviously the Brosnan era campiness and goofiness to it, but it plays it relatively straight for the first about 30, 40 minutes.
Let's say 25.
All right, yes. Basically, once he gets to Cuba,
I think everything goes out the window when he says thanks for the kiss of life without even pretending to hide his Irish accent.
Okay, fair point. Though I would still say, at least it's like, okay, we're still within reasonable Bond territory there.
Yes.
That's the one thing. When you get to the Cuba stuff and suddenly he's entering sneaking in to try and assassinate the prisoner he was exchanged for, who's escaped, who's now in Cuba there, getting this gene therapy thing. And Bond ends up in this, weird clinic where this is all going on, where they have rotating glass mirrors because they wanted to shove in a nod to Man with the Golden Gun, even though that really doesn't make a lot of sense to have those in what is ostensibly a clinic.
So it's a wild, like, almost really cool set.
It is. Oh, yeah. It's visually stunning, but it's one of those things where it's like, logic be damned here at this point in time.
Oh, yeah. There's no logic in this movie whatsoever.
Yeah. And, but yeah, okay, fine. We're still within reasonable Bond territory if, you know, getting into sci-fi Bond, which is always dicey territory. See Moonraker. But
usually takes about 20 years for dicey sci-fi Bond to get to be appreciated. So maybe in a couple more years, I'll like this one.
It's possible. But basically what ends up happening is, okay, fine, we're that. Then the film, you know, after Bond discovers that, yes, this is somehow involving conflict diamonds and this weird individual, Gustav Graves, who apparently in the course of 18 months has miraculously appeared, made millions, is getting knighted, and is developing a satellite technology in secret as part of this Icarus project. Okay.
Getting knighted.
Yeah, getting knighted.
Appears out of thin air.
Yeah.
And in 18 months, becomes a knight.
Yeah, yeah. Apparently, this is something that can happen in the realm of the Bond series. But again, sliding timescale, Bond has technically been alive since 1962. we'll go with that. But yes, somehow Bond ends up, you know, after getting spotted by what turns out to actually be an MI6 agent working for M, Miranda Frost, played by Rosamund Pike early on in her career.
Oh, boy, yeah. Dave, she's really good in this.
Yeah.
With what she has, which is very little.
Oh, God, yeah. This barely counts as a character. But yes, this ends up leading to Bond finally being reinstated by MI6 to go after Gustav and shake things up in an effort to try and figure out what's really going on. This somehow leads to an ice palace. That's a word that just came out of my mouth in the context of a James Bond film that was not created by Jor-El, and which in this instance here, yes, is a part of a big launching of, yes, the Icarus Project, which it turns out to be basically Blofeld's plot from Diamonds Are Forever, where he has a giant satellite that he's going to nuke the Earth with. Turns out that actually, Gustav Graves is actually Colonel Moon, the target that Bond supposedly killed at the start of the film. And despite the questions about whether it's really in good taste to have somebody's ethnicity erased for the purposes of a James Bond film as part of its plot.
Dave, I believe the term is whitewashed.
Yes, very, very much whitewashed. Yes, Bond must somehow confront and stop Graves with the help of Jinx and also with the help of an invisible car. Again, these are words coming out of my mouth right now in reference to a James Bond film.
Yeah.
So, yeah, needless to say, this film is basically known for going hog wild in terms of its tone over the course of it, where we effectively get like three or four different eras of Bond movies shoved into one, regardless of the logic of that. And the script doesn't hold together. Brosnan, I think it's very clear that he's dissatisfied by the end of this movie with what has come of it.
Yeah, he's clearly checked out.
Yeah, Halle Berry's Jinx spinoff series does not happen, thus depriving Michael Madison of whatever paychecks he could have received for playing her boss.
Oh, God.
Thank God that didn't happen. And yeah, the Bond series is kind of left with the question of where it's going to go, which leads to ultimately the relaunch reboot start over with Daniel Craig, for which we can all be thankful up until Spectre, but that's for another time.
Yeah, maybe No Time to Die will pay Spectre its due.
It could be, although as I'm also looking at this film, it's notable they seem to be hinting at a sci-fi plot, maybe, with, you know, in terms of it. I'm a little bit questioning about where they're going with that one, because again,
oh yeah, for sure,
Bond and sci-fi, they don't mix. But yes, so, okay, we have this bonkers film, which, again, is really just a set of really poorly stylized action scenes strung together with the thinnest of characterization and logic and a, you know, clearly cashing a paycheck John Cleese's cue.
Yeah.
It's how on earth do you take this and make it into a novel? And I will say this. I give Raymond Benson...
The answer is quickly.
Yeah, because, okay, seeming as near as I can tell, Raymond Benson, he writes, like I said, 6 official Bond novels. And I will say this about Benson. I actually have read only a couple of his, but he's actually, to my memory, not a bad writer. He was somebody who, again, based on my initial impressions, clearly researches the hell out of his topics and... has that nasty habit of feeling I must include every bit of things I've learned about this country or this particular province or this area of the world in full, because if I had to learn it, you have to now as well. That's a little bit of a downside to his writing. But again, he was still very much within that sort of Fleming mold while occasionally interjecting a bit of, I guess, the more grandiosity of the Bond film plots into his works, as it were. Which, I mean, is a criticism you can sort of apply to most of the people who've written after Ian Fleming. I think Gardner's certainly a victim of injecting more film Bond into literary Bond.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, so...
Those are all, like, he wrote those with, like, Roger Moore in mind, for sure.
Yeah, exactly. So, we come to this novel, this film, and you have to look at this script and wonder... Okay, what on earth is he going to do? Because from the looks of the timeline, he probably didn't have a lot of time to write this book whatsoever when you have a completely separate Bond novel also being published in the same year. And when you don't have much of a script, I guess my question, James, is what the hell would you hope for with a novelization of a film like Die Another Day?
So what I was looking for, actually, was what we had talked about was like, with the hopes that this was, I guess, based on like an earlier draft with material that didn't make it to the film or somehow markedly different from the film itself, which, and I mean, like, it's pretty accurate. Like, it's a pretty straight up adaptation of the film that we get with only a few minor exceptions. And then the other thing I was hoping for was to see that if, and I'd like this is going to sound kind of mean, but like to see who's to blame for this movie sucking so hard.
Yeah.
Right. Like, was it Tam Ahori, like, out of his depth because, like, maybe he doesn't know what to do with a $150 million action movie, which he doesn't
know,
by the way, or was it something so fundamentally flawed from like the script level? And I would say that this is fundamentally flawed from the script level.
Well, absolutely, yeah. And for anybody who needs further evidence that Tom Ahori's out of his depth, see XXX State of the Union, or don't, probably save yourself the time.
He did that?
Yeah, that was his...
Like, the year after
that
this?
That was his follow-up, was doing, yeah, the XXX
sequel. Holy cow.
Yeah. So I go from Bond to doing the Bond knockoff with Ice Cube that at that time. But yeah, I mean, looking at this thing, I mean, it's pretty clear that, yeah, Purvis and Wade are the real architects, such as they are, of this disaster.
I think architect is a pretty good word, or project managers, let's say.
Yeah, because, yeah, all the flaws that exist in the film are to be found in the page. And part of me really wishes Benson had, while reading this, was wishing that Benson had basically said, to hell with this, I'm just going to go wholesale and start rewriting entire sections, inventing new dialogue and backstories, because this is never going to work as a book otherwise.
Or take like a different approach. Like, I've never read any of Benson's Bond novels, but like based on this, like he's got that same sort of style that you had said, like the sort of like kind of travelogue-ish, which Fleming was really good at.
Yeah.
Like, and like, despite him being kind of a terrible person.
Yes.
To anyone that was not a white heterosexual male, like, he's a very good writer.
Oh, yeah.
And like, the detail Fleming fills his novels with is always interesting, and it's always comes across as sort of like nonchalant, I guess. Like someone like drunkenly telling you a story at a country club.
Yeah.
Whereas this is just like really straightforward and it still has that kind of detail, but it's just like, I have to add detail to add detail.
Well, that's the thing. Like, you can, there are moments when you're reading this book where you can feel that where Benson is flexing his muscles and you can see that he's at least injecting a little bits and pieces of things that he is interested in or thinks might give a little bit of flair to this. But There are very rare opportunities to do that. And probably the most successful portion of this book that does that is there's a sequence in the film when you're watching it, because where Bond, after he escapes his sort of prison hospital that he finds himself in after the prisoner exchange in which he is traded for back and is back in British hands. Effectively, yeah. What we see in the film is he either fakes a heart attack or actually has a heart attack.
He slows his heart down. To fool the monitor to think that he has gone into cardiac arrest.
That's, yeah.
And when they come in to resuscitate him, he escapes because this is something that he learned to do. Like, the book actually does a good job of, it's the way Benson writes it, it's like super hokey.
Yeah.
And like actually really cheesy. But like the idea behind it is there that like this is something that Bond has taught himself how to do to maintain, I don't know, his sanity or to like get through. Yeah. Torture, right? Yeah. Just to, so he, anyway.
It's the sort of detail that you would expect to find in like a Remo Williams novel, which is
a destroyer novel.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I mean, it's ridiculous, but it's like, okay, we're still within the realm of the technically plausible. As it's executed on screen, I mean, it's harder to tell. Like, I don't know whether that much thought went into Purvis and Wade's script or Tom Ahori's execution of it for it to be bother being clear. But yeah, the point is Bond escapes in the film, and the way it's staged in the film, either one of two things have happened. Either Bond is on a boat that's in China already and he swims from the boat to get to the mainland and then heads directly to a hotel.
Yep.
Or he's on a boat that's in North or that's in South Korea and then he swam the entire way to China from South Korea to make its way to a hotel. It's not clear either way.
No, the film has no interest.
Exactly. I mean, it just needs to get on to the next set piece, which is ripping off a bit from Russia with Love, or at least tipping its hat off to From Russia with Love. Mm-hmm. But in the case of Benson, he actually invents and I'm going to say it's an innovation because I don't think Purvis and Wade would have come up with this. This does not seem like it's in their wheelhouse.
No, it doesn't.
But effectively, it's a sequence where Bond is in South Korea. He gets off the boat and the first thing he does is he hits up a bar in order to basically roll a guy over for money. And he keeps hitting up other bars in order to locate people he needs. And finally gets himself somebody that it's like, look, I just helped pay off your gambling debts by beating up this guy who was effectively going to shake you down for it. Can you do me the solid and let me get onto your boat so that's heading over to Hong Kong? And yeah, basically we have Bond stowing away and putting the fact that, yes, he once worked in the, or was once a member of the Navy. He is a naval commander. And using that information to hide his way through the entire trip without getting discovered on its way to Hong Kong. That's actually a pretty good sequence. And yeah, would have been something I would have loved, you know, wouldn't be out of place in, say, an Ian Fleming novel necessarily.
Yeah. Or maybe in a Timothy Dalton film.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it's the sort of thing where it's like, okay, yeah, this is spy fantasy, but it's still within the realm of just heightened enough without going overboard to work. I could even see Daniel Craig having a sequence like that in one of his films. Like,
but it's like, it's Bond doing something that's not just going into, I don't know, like a hospital in Cuba and shooting people or like blowing stuff up, right? Like, this movie particularly is like one of the most egregious, like, Bond's actually kind of an idiot.
Yeah.
And just wins on dumb luck. But like this sequence in the novel has like a really interesting sort of like shows him doing spy-ish craft or using his spy craft to benefit himself. And I like that in the novel, you know, the first thing he concerns himself with is his appearance, right?
Yeah.
Like in the movie, if y'all don't remember, when he's just in like hospital scrubs, when he like jumps off the boat and he's like, hasn't shaved in 18 months. He hasn't had a haircut in 18 months. And he swims up and gets off, like, it goes into the hotel and, like, asks for a room. And he's dressed like, you know, like an escaped mental patient. I don't even think I should be using that term. But, like, and, like, it plays for, like, it's supposed to play for a big guffaw, which it totally does not. But like this is like a little bit more like you would get that sort of like, okay, he's like actually a spy and like this isn't a jokey movie.
Well, exactly. I mean, yeah, this is the part where you feel like, yeah, Bond is Bond and Bond is doing his job and making his way through it. And again, it shows that, yes, the logic of this world in international politics makes sense because he still has to operate within them in order to get anywhere. So, I mean, it's very clear. I mean, Benson was all we should note here as well, years before he was writing the Bond novels, actually wrote an entire sort of unauthorized guide to the Bond novels and films. And
that's right, he did.
Yeah, and he was very well researched. And again, there are points as...
He won like an Edgar Allan Poe Award or something, didn't
something
he?
Something, yeah, to that effect. It was one of those sort of literary awards from the genre-focused groups. But I mean, it's one of those things where, yeah, I mean, he is somebody who, he knows his Bond history, and when he's allowed to write the character correctly, effectively, and is able to ignore the dialogue he's given and the sequences that he has to work with, he actually does a pretty decent job of writing Bond. Unfortunately, when he's not doing that, I mean, it's very clear he's on autopilot. And I think probably one of the worst aspects of that, aside from the chapter titles, which are just painful. I mean, I'll read a few of the 22 chapters here, titles here. Surf's Up, Chapter 1. Chapter 2, Shooting Gallery. Chapter 3, Ordeal. Bet you it took you a lot of time to come up with that one, Benson.
Yeah.
Chapter 4, Impatient Patient. It's like, God, and it goes on from there. But I mean, I would say the other big one is the, basically the Gentleman's Club sequence from the film where Bond is back in England, in London, and basically goes into a fencing match with Gustav Graves, which is notable for A, featuring probably the worst cameo in any Bond film in existence, and that being...
Yeah, it's pretty bad. Madonna?
Yeah, she is, yeah, supposedly a fencing instructor, and in 20 years she still hasn't learned to act by that point. Like, I mean, she's been at it for that long, and she can't deliver a line of dialogue to save her life. But I mean, it's a ridiculous sequence in the context of the film, where basically it's an excuse to have Bond get into a giant sword fight with Toby Stevens, and it goes all over this gentleman's club, smashing things down, destroying property. Like, and I will say this, as it's not a great scene, but it's probably one of the more lively ones in the film.
Yeah, it is. I mean, like, that scene is like cut pretty decently.
Yeah.
In terms of like a, like its action spectacle.
Yeah.
And its choreography, right? It's the it's like the most, I guess, like low tech, let's say, because there's no pyrotechnics, there's no like cars or bombs or
It's kind of hard to do
or guns, right? Like it's a sword fight.
Yeah. You can't really do speed ramping with Pierce Brosnan and Toby Stevens. No. I mean, but that's the thing. Like, I mean, it really is a half decent sequence. Well, how do you execute that in the form of a novel? Well, I give him credit. It seems like Benson has done his research, but basically it comes down to, oh, and here's one actual real life fencing technique that I'm actually going to name drop in here at this point in time. Did you know, here, there will be a quiz at the end of this novel? And that's really how painful it reads, where it's like, yep, Bond is mastered all of these techniques which don't really matter and doesn't make what is ostensibly physical visual spectacle work in literary form. Like, I mean, you would think that they'd focus more on, say, something like, what is Bond thinking in this moment? Or what is Graves/Moon thinking in this sequence? Or how does...
Yeah, you get, like, none of that.
Yeah, or what is, how does Miranda Frost observe the sequence? Which, again, would have probably made that much more interesting to... It's like, oh, let's just forget trying to hide the fact that she's a double agent, or triple agent, actually, as it were, in this film, and just reveal, you know, straight up the fact that, yes, she's observing these things from her perspective and seeing what's going on. But no, instead, yeah, it's just, and Bond pirouetted, and so on, and so forth. Yeah, I couldn't be bothered to go with that. But effectively, I mean, that's the sort of thing where so much of this book is just that kind of autopilot, just get it done and get it in. And you really get the feeling that Benson, just his heart is not in this
whatsoever. No, it's not. And like, I sent you a picture of this, Dave.
Yeah.
But in like one of the chapters, like it's just like really kind of like sloppy writing. There's like a paragraph break when he gets to the hotel, and he's had a bit of a haircut, still has a beard, and he gets to his room, there's the paragraph break, and then it says 3 hours later, Bond put down his Phyllis shave. First of all, like the dropping of like the Phyllis shave, like I get that that's what Fleming would do when he would like name his like the types of vodkas or gins that he would do, but like 2002 like technology, like electric shaver stuff, like it comes across, like every time that happens, like I had like a chuckle. like when like Moon took the tank buster gun and blew up the helicopter, like ugh. Like, none of it sounds good. But the way that that sentence is written, though, it makes it sound like Bond had been shaving for 3 hours.
Yes, which, yeah, admittedly, that's the kind of thing maybe the editor should have noted on this one.
I did not to be that guy, but I did notice a couple typos.
Well, yeah, and I'm willing to, you know, that could be the people setting the print text at that point. But I mean, it is the sort of thing that makes you wonder that when you look at the legalese at the start and you read, again, the actual statement on the inside legalese page here. The right of Raymond Benson to be identified as the author of this work has been asserted by him in accordance with Copyright Designs and Patent Act 1988. I just like to know, Mr. Benson, you didn't have to assert that right. I'm just saying. I mean, I'm sure that there were some royalty checks that you may have received for this one, but nobody was going to blame you for not asserting ownership over this text. It may have been to your benefit not to. But yeah, I mean, that the whole book is filled with that sort of thing. And I mean, even the stuff that kind of works in the film, or at least works in as much as it can in the film, doesn't really translate terribly well to the written page. So, I mean, we get things like, I mean, again, some of the egregious stuff in the novel. Bond's absolutely superfluous VR training sequence, which, again, has no function in this movie other than to give a quote-unquote funny introduction to John Cleese's Q and set up a pretty lousy gag for Moneypenny at the end of it.
I will say, like, as bad as that setup and that gag is in the movie, it works, like, even worse in the book, because the way Benson just slot, especially the Moneypenny gag at the end, the way he just slots it in as like a one page thing at the, in like the end chapter, like, why did you even put that in there?
Well, and that's the thing, like, I mean, that's the sort of thing that should have easily been deleted from the book at that point, because it adds nothing. And again, that would have saved up and freed up space for Benson to maybe expand upon other things, like, who the hell is Falco? Why, you know, what is his deal? Why does he just act like every other Michael Madsen character that has ever existed in this film or in this context? I mean, it could have offered room to expand Jinx, who barely registers as a character in the film version. And I honestly can't recall any meaningful details being added by Benson to flesh her out as a character that you might at
least
hope
for. There's, like, a couple things. Like, he notes that, like, she was, I think she was orphaned. I think it said her mother died in childbirth or something. Or maybe that was a different movie I was watching last night. I don't know. But, like, it mentioned, like, that she was a gymnast growing up. Like, that kind of stuff. Which, like, none of it really registers, and it's all just sort of, I guess, padding.
Well, absolutely. And I mean, I give Benson at least maybe a little bit of credit towards the end for taking what is sort of implied in the film and making a little bit more, well, barely implied in the film, Miranda Frost's backstory as an Olympic fencing champion and the OD of the individual. I mean, if you read between the lines, you can assume that, yes, she, based on the fact that, yes, spoilers, she turns out to be a traitor to MI6, that she, yes, cheated her way to getting the gold medal at the end of the day. Here, at least, it establishes that, oh, there was actually a point where her and Moon encountered one another, not just, yeah, that happened at some point in time.
Yeah, it's in the book, it's a throwaway line about how they were both on the same fencing team at Harvard together.
Yeah, and then that eventually he helped poison the other winner for her shortly thereafter. And like I said, that's okay. That's at least a little bit of fleshing out, at least establishing that there is an actual relationship between these people, because Frost in the film, like, there is no motivating factor for her in that movie at all. Like,
no, especially to team up with Moon/Graves. Not that there's much given in here. It's just like Benson writes it off as, like, I thought I had the quote somewhere, but like, what is it? They had a mutual respect for each other.
Yeah.
Like basically was like it. And then she's like, okay, I'm going to be an evil spy.
Yeah. I'm going to assume that this was the passage you were going for. And I will read this just a little bit here, just to give you some more taste here, folks, of this. It wasn't difficult. Colonel Moon and Miranda developed an unholy alliance in Sydney based on a mutual interest in power. Moon liked to rule and Miranda liked to win. I can guarantee that you will receive the gold medal, Moon had told her. Really? How? He had her attention. That's my secret. What do I have to do? Sleep with you? No, nothing so crude, he said, reaching out and stroking her golden hair. My price for the service would be your undying loyalty. You already have that, even though I'm a military radical in a communist country. Oddly enough, I find that appealing, she answered. End scene.
Yeah.
That's the level of nuance and depth that's being added.
I will say, this is like the stuff that I found interesting, because it's the stuff that's left out of the film that Benson was obviously left to his own devices to create.
Yeah.
But in here, it also shows, it's from that same passage, David, yeah, just a couple pages prior, that this odd details that really throw me off, especially in a quote-unquote woke 2020, when he writes, Moon was a young, vigorous, and handsome Asian man with wealth and power. Miranda Frost was attracted to him, but not necessarily in a sexual way. Likewise, Moon wasn't drawn to the Western woman in a physical sense. In fact, he was not much of a sexual being. What is the point of that?
Well, if anything, that's Benson reinserting probably one of the more unfortunate tendencies in Fleming's work, which is that sort of villainization of anything that isn't straight heterosexual masculinity.
Right.
There, because, Fleming's works are rampant with it. And...
Oh, totally.
Yeah, I mean...
A lot of his villains are coded, gay or lesbian or, what's that word I'm looking for? Just, deviant.
Yeah, quote-unquote, yeah.
In some way, yeah.
Yeah, and that's the thing. And, certain authors, in the year since, trying to deal with the legacy of Fleming has always been one of those things that's, how much do you keep? What can you extract from him and keep going forward? And there are interesting examples like Anthony Horowitz's Trigger Mortis, which you and I, James, were talking about beforehand, is technically, it falls right after the events of Goldfinger. And it's very interesting how he deals with, again, some of Fleming's lesser tendencies by basically adding a nice little coda to the James Bond pussy galore relationship on that one, because for anybody who's read the book and seen the film adaptation, yes, Bond is so magnificent as a sexual lover that he effectively, turns pussy galore from lesbianism to heterosexual relationships. Well, Horowitz flips that on its head by basically eventually having it turn out, no, she eventually leaves Bond for another woman, and that he did not actually have the... funny enough, a woman he completely strikes out with as well in the course of the book. So,
that's a shame.
Yeah, it's one of those things where it's like, okay, at least, there's some recognition that, yeah, what Fleming was writing isn't going to fly in this era. And Benson, unfortunately, I'm sure when he's writing that would probably say, well, no, I'm toning it down. It's not quite there anymore.
But still, it's an odd way to just condescend.
Yeah.
To that. It actually serves no purpose.
Yeah.
It would have been a little more interesting to reveal that, in fact, maybe they were lovers or, I don't know, something, or just not even address it, just leave it out and just let us draw any sort of conclusion that we want.
Well, you're absolutely right. And Benson is guilty of this at various points. Even things on page 5 of this book, when we're still in the pre-credit sequence of the film, Benson is introduced to the two, and actually named the people who are working with Bond to pull off this cover op in North Korea. And, you have midway through the page, Bond stepped forward and took the passenger's briefcase. The two Koreans worked quickly. Why go to the point of giving them names and then not using them and then reducing them to, and yes, these, again, we sort of gave you a character and now we're, basically reducing you to, and you're the Korean sidekicks in this instance. There's so much of that that happens in this book where it's like, yeah, at the very least, don't draw attention to it and then try and push it to the margins again,
yeah,
as well. And yeah, Benson, that's definitely not his strong point, at least here. Again, I remember him being somewhat better in particularly the novel he did dealing with the handover of mainland China, or of Hong Kong to mainland China, that he wrote around the same time that Tomorrow Never Dies was happening, which, yeah, I guess does make Benson, the one individual to write two novels around basically the exact same subject matter. Maybe that one worked out better. I don't know. But yeah, I mean, that's the, in many ways, this feels really disappointing, given what it is compared to something like, again, recently I read for the first time, Gene Roddenberry's novelization of, Star Trek, the motion picture, back in the '70s. And whatever else you can say about Roddenberry, at least in that context, goes for broke and tries to, in, you know, basically make it a novel, more of an above and beyond anything else. Like, he is no problem filling in the details or doing things that you simply cannot do in a feature film, like using footnotes and endnotes and actually establishing that there are portions, that this whole thing's being written from the point of view of what is ostensibly James Kirk's official biographer, and there, and doing weird little things and diving into things like, well, what is the actual nature of Spock and Kirk's relationship? Is it sexual? I kid you not, he actually has a passage that dedicated to dealing with that. And yeah, Benson does nothing so adventurous, which on one hand, I'm looking at this thinking, well, would, I guess, the target audience for the novelization of Die Another Day necessarily be looking for that, on the other hand, and Benson's just giving them what they want. But that feels really cheap to say when you consider that Benson, again, as a hardcore Bond fan and literary writer himself, you would think that he would probably take into account that there would be tons of people coming to this book who are fans of Bond as a literary figure and are not just looking for the quick, cheap tie-in that's being tossed out to coexist in theaters.
I mean, especially considering, like, as you said, Dave, who he is and, like, his history with Bond. Like, have fun with it a little bit more. Or maybe this is him having fun with it.
Well, exactly. And if I'm not mistaken, I think Gardner, like, I haven't actually read his, the two novelizations he did, but if I'm not mistaken, I think I've read somewhere that he actually tried to make his novelizations canon with his extended canon books as well.
He did with License to Kill, as far as I can remember.
Okay. Which, yeah,
I never read GoldenEye.
Yeah, and I haven't read either of them, unfortunately. I mean, I think GoldenEye is relatively easily available. I'm not sure License to Kill is necessarily that as accessible these days. But that's the thing. Like, I mean, Benson doesn't even make that effort, which, I mean, would at least make the novel semi-interesting in terms of, okay, well, how is he trying to connect the dots between his clearly has nothing to do with what Eon's Bond films are and what's going on in this one. I mean, I guess even more to the point, I mean, let's take it back to the sort of the overall context of what Die Another Day was in general, which is Bond as a celebration. Okay, the Bond movie that is supposed to celebrate the history of Bond. I will say this for the film. I don't particularly like it, but it also does what it says on the tin in that regard, because, I mean, in the most cheap, superficial way possible, yes, this is a celebration of the history of James Bond as a feature film character, and even bits and pieces of his literary past, and with in jokes and nods such as Bond picking up the bird watching guide at the point, hinting to where Ian Fleming got the name for the character, or things such as, you know, Q drop saying that this is Bond's 20th watch, I believe, there.
Yeah.
Okay, again, it's cheap, it's easy, but at least it's an effort of some sort to sit there and say, hey, yeah, 20 years, or 20 Bond films, 40 years, hasn't it been an exciting time? And then, you know, you look at the film and say, well, up until this point it was, but, you know, there we go. The book, you would at least think that maybe Benson could at least have a little bit of fun in the same regard and try and at least work in something to that same effect in terms of this being, you know, a Bond novel that's ostensibly part of the big celebration of this. And
yeah, the only thing I noticed in that sort of like regard was like an offhand reference to like when Bond, after he's like left in the cold, after he parasails on the melting iceberg.
Yes.
Oh boy. And he's like trying to make his way back to the ice palace.
Yeah.
Benson writes that like he would take anything for like a mode of transportation, even a cello case. Like,
yeah. So, I mean, yeah, that's about the only real addition that we get in terms of this book. And I feel disappointed. Like, I mean, you could have, I mean, again, even if, you know, it would be a small thing, why not make the effort to try and, like, you know, work with Bond's character and try and line up his adventures in a way that, you know, at least makes some semblance of sense here, where, like, you know, why he's in the prison sequence. Which, again, I mean, for those who remember, in the film, when Bond's in his 18 months of torture, it's actually, that's the opening credit sequence of the film, as Madonna's debatably awful opening.
Definitely awful.
It's, I enjoy it in a very cheesy way. I admit, it's one of the worst Bond songs, but I still get something of a kick out of it. It's, yeah, I mean, you can't do that on the page. So instead, Benson does come up with a half-decent sequence of Bond basically coming in and out of getting tortured over that time. But again, you know, why not have him reflecting on, like, his past missions or trying to make sense of the timeline of Bond's life in a way that doesn't really make sense when you consider, again, as far as the feature films are concerned, Bond is always in his, what, late four or early 40s, maybe mid-40s.
I guess so.
Even when he's looked like, you know, 60-odd-year-old Roger Moore. One of those things that happens, like, you know, well, when my wife died, you know, 5 years ago, or whatever the case may be. Like, there's no real...
Yeah.
Like, again, it would be show a little effort to try and do some weird fan service-y stuff. And again, I know I'm somebody who comes down often hard on fan service for fan service sake, but if there was ever a book you were going to do that with when you don't have much of a story, this might be the one to do it with. I mean, I know you risk becoming like a clip show version of a novel at that point. And here's that time when I described a much better sequence from a much better movie. But
but I mean, like, the movie doesn't do that either, right? Like, all of its references are, like, are visual, you know, visual nods, right?
Yeah.
Like you said, like, he picks up the bird watching book. Actually, Benson notes that in the novel too, with, like, by a notable author. So they're like, haha, yes, we know his notes, James Bond.
Yeah.
But, like, it's like, you know, Halle Berry coming out of the ocean in a bikini referencing Ursula Andress.
Yeah.
It's the diamond
satellite yeah
thing. And even, like, David Arnold's score, which I think is actually half decent.
Yeah.
Right? Like, he nicely weaves in some little, I guess, motifs or bars here and there of other John Barry scores. Like, there's hints, like, hints of Diamonds Are Forever, hints of Moonraker, all throughout, which is nice too. But, like, you can't do that in, like, other than, can't do that on the page, but, like, other than that, this movie shows no history.
Yeah.
Like, make reference to, like, an old adventure, or, like, boy, this is, like, last time, you know, MI6 blew up, isn't this crazy? Just, like, any sort of, like, wink or, like, just, like, a line of dialogue or, like, something that has, shows that this isn't just, like, a time capsule or, like, a bottled adventure.
Well, absolutely. I mean, it could, I mean, hell, I mean, go the extra mile and say, well, you know, maybe connect it back to Dr. No, or maybe, I mean, I know they couldn't bring back Spectre at this point, thanks to the legal issues at that point, but
yeah.
I mean, you could have, yeah, again, you could have, you know, I again, I'm not the biggest fan of the villain Goldfinger. I think he's highly overrated, but again, that would at least be, it's like, oh yeah, we're referencing, you know, big moments in history, and, you know, maybe our villain is, you know, Son of Goldfinger. I mean, that'd be terrible, but...
Son of Goldfinger.
Yeah, it would still be, you know, it's like, okay.
Isn't he from James Bond Jr.?
Why not? I mean, again, you know, if it had been me writing this novelization, I would have even, you know, why not drop in a reference to that little, you know, annoying nephew of mine that I'm still not entirely sure is actually biologically my family. You know, do something like that. In there. I mean, yeah, I mean, really, really play with the idea of it. But no, I mean, it's, and again, I mean, with fairness to Benson, I will say this. I don't know the circumstances under which he wrote this. It's entirely possible that,
again, quickly.
Yeah, I mean, it's odds are he was about, probably, you got 6 months till we have to put this thing to the printer, get it in and done, and just get it to me here. And it was probably just, all right, well, fine, I'll do this. It's just, you know, again, I say this as somebody who grew up with, like, you know, the golden age of Alan Dean Foster writing novelizations, the gold standard for this is what goes on, and thinking, well, yeah, let's have fun with this sort of thing. And it's, I think that's the real thing when it comes to novelizations. They should be fun on some level. as you're going through them. Even if you're adapting a junky story there, I mean, do something fun with it. I mean, and I know at the risk of James rolling his eyes and groaning right now.
Oh my God, he's going to talk about Doctor Who.
Yeah, it was going to be Doctor Who. I mean, the novel... most of the story of the original series was novelized, and they have done some novelizations of the a few of the modern episodes of the show. And again, the writers, I mean, and oftentimes in the, for particularly the recent ones, the writers are the ones who actually wrote the episodes themselves, and they feel no obligation to stick with what they put in the episode at all. Like, they are entire sections where they are wholesale inventing new stuff or adding details or reworking complete bits, which make the books stand on their own and sort of a unique, distinct entity of on a, in and of itself there. And yeah, there's nothing to this book that really makes it function like that, or at least unique in that regard. So saying that out loud almost makes me wonder whether this was probably the right choice in hindsight to have actually started with for what might be a recurring segment on this program of ours. I'm not.
I mean, it's fine and it's fun, right? Yeah. Like, to talk about it, at least I will give Benson credit for very quickly rushing through the climax.
Yeah, the
of the film. It feels very truncated, which is fine, because I think, like, on film, like, that's one of my least favorite Bond sequences, when, like, they're on the plane and it's, like, going through the laser and it's catching fire. It's just like, ugh, it's so much yelling and it's like really bad post effects.
Yeah.
And it doesn't work.
It's a huge CGI nightmare. And again, Brosnan's checked out by that point. Like, I mean, he is so clearly not invested in what they're doing. Halle Berry, I mean, again, it's in that weird period of her career where she was on the rise.
She was an Oscar winner.
What? Did she have the Oscar by this point, or was that a couple of
years? Yeah, she won for Monsters Ball, which was 2001.
It was 2001? Okay. So she had her Oscar at this point, and now all of a sudden she's riding off that high into doing like this. This was your choice. Catwoman was your choice. Like, there's that period of time where career management was not her strong suit in the early 2000s. And like, I'm sure that part of it was her agent probably telling, it's like, they're talking about a spinoff. They're talking about making Jinx her own character in her own series.
I remember, like, the talk of Halle Berry getting a spinoff before this movie came out.
Yeah, and it's like,
right? Like, because she was a huge star.
Well, absolutely, and it's the things where it's like, okay, I guess maybe they are being serious about this before you see the film, because, yeah, I mean, you got Oscar, I mean, you got Halle Berry there. She's a big star. She's clearly desperately trying to get the hell away from the X-Men movies as fast as she can. So, yeah, this would make total sense. And then you see the film and no groundwork is laying for what her series would be. And the only thing I can say is that effectively the way they treat her character is very much like, say, Clifton Slay in Curse of the Pink Panther, where all she really seems to have is she is basically a insert female version of Bond, and she's got a boss who's basically just her equivalent of M, only a bit more grumbly and American. And that's it, really.
I know, like, they give her nothing and she does nothing with it.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, with fairness to her, it's kind of hard when you get dialogue such as "Yo mama," back at our very clear Mr. Kill, because again, innovation, yay. Or like just other random bits that just make no sense. Like her whole,
like, she doesn't like her like flirty dialogue with Bond.
Oh God, that scene
is atrocious. Like, they have zero chemistry together.
Yeah.
And it doesn't Dave, you've defeated me with this.
I know, but it's that's the thing about Die Another Day. It's like, just so much of this film just doesn't work. Like, literally, I honestly, my Letterboxd review is, you know, you got Rosamund Pike and you've got the opening sequence of this movie, which I think, take it as its own, if there was nothing of the film that followed beyond it, is actually a pretty decent opening scene to a Bond movie in terms.
Yeah, it is not bad. And I like the way that, I just want to go off on this because this is like the actual thing that I really like about the movie. Yeah. I like that the potential direction it goes in, like, Bond gets captured and he gets tortured and then he's traded back to MI6 and they're unsure of his allegiance now, which was, I was hoping this would go into that sort of like the way that the novel, The Man with the Golden Gun,
opens. Yeah, that's
right.
Yeah.
And like that's like, wouldn't that be an interesting idea to do? Like, you know, and even Bond questioning himself, right? Like, maybe I was turned. Like, who knows?
Well, absolutely. And to this day, I would love when they introduce our next Bond post Daniel Craig. I keep maintaining the opening sequence should be the opening from Man with the Golden Gun, the novel. Like, imagine if that's your introductory scene to our brand new Bond, him attempting to assassinate M right off the bat. It's like, okay, all bets are off at this point in time. You could take this character in any direction and not just be a repeat of the Daniel Craig character arc of the last few films at this point, which, again, I'm still not sure how they're going to pay that off when we finally eventually get to see our next Bond movie, preferably in a theater, hopefully.
Yeah.
But that's the thing. Like, there's so much potential that was there, and then it's just squandered bit by bit. And again, I mean, if I can divorce the film that I wanted from the one that we got, again, it's Die Another Day. At least it gets you your Bond fix, not in the best way, but at least you know it's not like 3 hours in length, Spectre. But it's, yeah. So, you know, you get it in and you get out within a fairly reasonable amount of time,
I guess. I mean, like, still, it's 2 hours and 12 minutes long, Dave. That's...
Yeah.
It's like the same length as all the Roger Moore ones, but this one feels a little bit...
longer in the tooth compared.
Longer, yeah. The other thing, it's like Purvis and Wade, who clearly have done their research because they know how to put these together in whatever fashion that they choose to do it. But, like, there's even, like, those, like, interesting ideas sort of dropped into it, like the idea that, you know, Colonel Moon, when he whitewashes himself,
yeah,
makes himself in the form of like his view of James Bond.
Yeah.
Like, there's something that could be really interesting done with that, but it does nothing.
Yeah, no, that's the thing. I mean, I that is probably the best line of dialogue in the film, actually, is Toby Stevens getting to deliver that line. It's like, I just made it a parody of you. Effectively. Yeah. And it's like, okay, yeah, that could have been interesting if you did something with it, but it also doesn't hold up to much scrutiny when you then realize that his parody of Bond, or his envisionment of Bond, is of a corporate CEO who's out in front of the whole world.
It's Elon Musk.
Yeah, it's like, I'm not sure you know how James Bond is at this point. I mean,
yeah, do you know what he does for a living? Like,
that's right. You know, I started this brokerage firm and I became exactly like you. Wait, what? Hold on a second. Yeah, you know, the company, Universal Exports. I mean, I got into business just like you. It's frustrating all around as a film. And yeah, I guess when you get right down to it, this is a case where I think the novelization had the potential to be better than the film. Mm-hmm. And instead, I don't want to say it's worse than the film, but it's just as bad in a different way for other reasons.
Yes.
Because it can't do any of the things that the film at least does semi-right for the most part. So, I mean, yeah, this is really a case of pick your poison more than anything else this for now. But I would like to say, if Eon has changed their minds and they do indeed want to do a novelization of No Time to Die, James and I would be happy to look at the film in advance.
Yeah.
And I'm sure we could rewrite a Bond novel. I would be very willing to totally rewrite Blofeld and just basically make a liar out of him for most of his actions in Spectre. that's where I'm at still here, folks.
I don't know. I guess we should probably wrap this up.
Yeah.
We've been talking about a novel, the worst James Bond movie, for 90 minutes.
Yeah. So on that note, we'll have a regular episode coming up next year, folks. And we'll try and maybe find a more, hopefully, more interesting novel/film combo for the next time we do this.
I'm trying to think, like, I've heard that, like, The Abyss is supposed to be actually a decent novel, written by Orson Scott Card, who wrote the Ender's Game series.
Yeah, I mean, putting aside that Card is a homophobic monster in many ways, I mean, yeah, I've heard the same thing about that myself. I mean, and then there's other ones there. I mean, certainly looking at my shelf, I mean, I'm sure you and I could both find something to say about Rima Williams, The Adventure Begins.
Yeah, let's just keep talking about basically James Bond.
Yeah, I mean, although there is also the novelization of Close Encounters of the Third Kind, which I have not read, but is sitting on my shelf. That's quote unquote written by Steven Spielberg.
Mm-hmm.
Which I'm sure is just as likely as the time George Lucas wrote that Star Wars novel that we talked about at the start here. But we'll look into this, folks. I'm sure we can come up with something pretty interesting, something probably more unique than this one turned out to be. Or maybe not. You can give us our feedback and tell us what you liked and didn't like about this one.
Or if you just generally want to dunk on Die Another Day.
Yeah, we're also completely up for that. Where can they find you, James?
You can find me on Twitter at James Riv. It's at J-H-R-I-V. No, I don't even know what it is. I'll have to get back at
you. I'll look up your Twitter handle while we do that right now. You can find me at 24 Panels here, folks. Like I said, I'm always up for a civil conversation. If you also happen to have read some of the Doctor Who novelizations that have been published recently, I am also willing to discuss it. Clearly, Stephen Moffat was having a ball writing the Day of the Doctor novelization.
Dave would also be happy to talk about the novelization of the Genesis album Invisible Touch.
I would I am also willing to sit there and say if, you know, Phil Collins, Tony Banks, and Michael Rutherford need another income line by licensing out there, I've got $5. I can give that out to you. Let's see here. I would be very happy to novelize even The Lamb Lies Down on Broadway. It won't be good, but it will be a novel. I can guarantee that. let's see here.
So anyway, you can find me at J_Rivnak, H-R-I-V-N-A-K, the H is silent.
There we go. So yeah, folks, please let us know what you would want out of these, what you liked about this one, what you don't want us to do ever again. We'll be happy to follow suit on that. and yeah, so like I said, we'll definitely be back next time with, I'm not sure what episode we're going to be posting this in between, so I can't say exactly what film is coming next. So until then, yeah, we guess we probably should have come up with some sort of catchy catchphrase to end this one. Like I said, we don't have Andrew to toss to on this one.
That's true. Maybe he can at least sing us out with Madonna's Die Another Day.
I have no problem pitching that idea to him. I feel he'll probably enjoy it. So until then, folks, Die Another Day?
Oh, God. Thanks.